The intricacies of Dinacharya, Ayurvedic daily routine, and all the wonders and vitality that that brings to the physiology, and Guru, that aspect of consciousness which removes darkness so light can prevail. Welcome to the Vital Veda podcast. I'm your host, Dylan Smith. I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner and holistic health educator, and so grateful to be communing and discussing with all these experts on these topics which we talk about, which is health, consciousness, spirituality, the laws of nature, which we call the Veda, and which Ayurveda, the health aspect of the laws of nature, health governed by natural law, is Ayurveda. And today we have an expert and beautiful, generous in his knowledge and the intricacies and the details and the precise, holistic look into why we do certain practices in Ayurveda is truly beautiful. And I just want to share with you where our guest comes from. And, you know, I've been learning Ayurveda for a number of years, you know, coming up towards a decade. And it was with this family called the Raju family of doctors that I was learning with. Now, at the moment in India, there's only a few families that have this unbroken lineage of Ayurvedic knowledge, this genuine, pure knowledge, because due to the invasions like the Mongol invasions with the Muslims and the more recent British invasion of India, a lot of this knowledge was lost. And at the moment, there's only really a bunch of families, a handful of families that have that unbroken lineage. And one of them is the Raju family of Ayurvedic doctors who are based in the state of India called Telangana. And Aditya Raju is one of them, one of the doctors at the moment. And he is the son of the world-renowned Dr. J.R. Raju, who is a saint, really, in Ayurvedic medicine and medicine. And he is very renowned for pulse diagnosis, for his ability to understand at a very deep and broad level of what is going on in the physiology through feeling one's radial pulse. And this knowledge, of course, has been passed all throughout his family. And there's many, his children and his brothers and sisters and grandchildren now are learning, and there's more and more. So we're very blessed to have this knowledge of the pulse and knowledge of Ayurveda. And Aditya, you can see by his intricate knowledge, it's really beautiful. And he shared a lot with us today. So that's Aditya. Aditya is a pulse diagnosis master. He's an expert in the pulse. He's also expert in Marma therapy, which is basically where acupuncture points come from. It's like the subtle, vital, pranic storehouses of energy, the points on the body that stores this pranic life force, this concentration of energy, and many other things. Panchakarma, which is detox and rejuvenation. So you're going to get to know him. And if you want to learn about pulse diagnosis and how to feel your own pulse, and really feeling your own pulse as a self-referral mechanism, because your pulse, believe it or not, is expressing a huge amount of information from your physiology, from your mind, from your body, from your consciousness, from your emotional body, your spirit body. There's so much to it. Your blood circulates through every cell in the body in a matter of minutes or less. And that expresses itself in the pulse. The pulse comes from the heart, the emotions, and this concept in Ayurveda called ojas, which is immunity, reproductive capability. All this and beyond is expressed in the pulse. And that's why feeling your own pulse can be a profound technique to align you with your body and become aware of a part of your body and mind which is perhaps more subtle and more profound. So we're teaching with this Raju family, with Aditya's father and Aditya's brother, these techniques and certain techniques to trigger healing. And that will be, you can see information that there's two lectures, and we will continue more of these. But for now, there's the two introductory lectures for everyone, whether you're very experienced in Ayurveda or you're brand new to it. And you can head to the Vital Veda website, vitalveda.com.au/courses, or just click on the courses section of our website and you'll see this, and you can repeat it after as many times as you want. You can purchase the recordings and join the group. So this is the pulse diagnosis, and that's one aspect we'd like to share, one gift from the family of Rajus that we will be having. So hope you enjoy this podcast. It's one for the Vedic nerds as well, certainly. We get deep into these subtle laws of nature and exploring certain stories which have relevance today, And you know, you'll see the usual question we ask, the first question we ask to our Vital Veda podcast guests was so extended that it came into a topic for itself. This is the beauty of Aditya's beautiful detail and generous and elaboration, really unpacking something in a very wholesome, complete level. So enjoy and thank you for listening. Okay, Jay Gurudev, thank you so much for joining me, Aditya-ji. On this very auspicious day, we are right now, the full moon in Australia peaked at about 6 hours ago, and it's the full moon, which we call Guru Purnima, which we'll talk about, the fullest full moon of the year, the brightest full moon of the year. And thank you for joining me on this very auspicious occasion. So before we start, what we ask every guest is, what did you do this morning? Or what was your dinacharya? You know, this is, what was your daily routine?
Jai Gurudev.
Jai Gurudev.
Jai Gurudev. Well, we happen to be having this podcast on a very auspicious occasion. So it's the dinacharya is a little bit different than the usual dinacharya. Because, as you know, today is Guru Purnima, the brightest and fullest full moon of the year. And also, just a couple of days ago, it was the Tuli Ekadashi, the first Ekadashi. So these are very significant muhurtas, as we call in Sanskrit. Muhurta means the auspicious time, very auspicious for, you know, in starting our year, almost, you can say. So, but not like, this is not the beginning of the year, but in terms of Ekadashi, this is the first Ekadashi. And then the Guru Purnima is also very significant because on this day, they do, what they do is this Chaturmasa Vrata. I'm not sure if anybody heard. So a lot, most, all the brahmacharis, the monks, they all go for this Vrata. It's very important because wherever they are, they start this Vrata, which is the Chaturmasa Vrata, after doing the Guru Puja and all that. It signifies that during this time, they become more inward. For 4 months, they don't move around as much. Preferably, they don't move at all. So they are in one place with total focus on their sadhana and their meditation, their puja, their dinacharya is very specific compared to the rest of the people. So, and it's amazing because you see, this is the time of the year when nature becomes a little bit more lively. If you see in nature, there will be a lot of rainfall happening. So a lot of all the different organisms, the microbial organisms, the plants and the flora, all of this become more and more active. So you'll see nature really coming alive, and even the people, their moods, their hormones, their minds and nature, everything is starting to shift from before this, during the rainy season, then the springtime, and all this is going to come. So for the 4 months, the monks, they do this Vrata, which is called Chaturmasa Vrata. But before we get into that, you asked what is my dinacharya for today. So today with the Guru Purnima and everything, the normal dinacharya is, you know, when you open your eyes, the first thing that we think of is what my grandfather was teaching us. You know, Karagre Vasate Lakshmi, Karamajje Tu Saraswati, Karamule Tu Gauri, or Govindam, Prabhate Karadarshanam. So the first thing that we see, we put our hands together, we rub them, and we put them together, and we say, in the beginning of the Kara. Kara means the ray of the sun, the single ray of the sun. So we put our hands, so those rays of the sun are considered as the hands, the fingers, the hands of the sun, and they are infinite. So Karagre, at the very beginning of the hands, is Lakshmi. And if you see, when you put your hands together, the very beginning of your hands coming together, it looks like a lotus almost. And Karamajjetu Saraswati. In the middle of the hands, you see there is Saraswati. So, and at the Karamuletu, at the very source of the very end of the hands, Karamule means source, roots. Karamuletu, some people say Govindam, who are more Vaishnava, and who are more Shakteya, they will say Karamuletu Gauri, which is the Mother Divine. She is the Aradhya of Govinda. So you can say she is even the source to Govinda, Lord Narayana. So like that, you see Mother Divine, all the three of them in your hands, and that is considered to be the most auspicious way to begin your awakening. Then, of course, before you put your feet down on the earth, there is a beautiful shloka that is Samudra Vasane Devi. So this shloka is again not everybody is doing all the time, but it is very important to remember that when you're putting your feet on the earth, you are remembering the our Mother Earth. So this shloka beautifully describes the tolerance and the compassion and the patience and the nurturing quality of Earth. And you are so you remember her, and you are very grateful for all the forgiveness and, you know, that energy from the earth. So you recognize that the earth is not just a planet, but it's a living, intelligence, a living divine intelligence. And in that awareness, you put your foot. You're putting your foot on your own mother. And it's a very beautiful way to start the first step, because you're aware what you're doing and you are in great reverence to Mother Divine, Mother Earth. And so everything that you do as if you're doing with your own mother. So you don't abuse the planet, you don't abuse all the different life forms that exists on the planet, and you recognize that you have a great advantage in terms of cognitive abilities and so forth. Human beings have a great advantage, and in that recognition, you are taking care of like your family, the different diverse family range, all the way from the very the microbials all the way up into the plants and animals and all the way to the human beings. Everybody is one unified connection to the mother.
Before we move on, I just love this because I love these detailed Jindacharyas with my guests. It's always like, how detailed can you get? But I love it. So we haven't even passed 1 minute of you waking up. I just want to elaborate because I do this devatas also in the palms, and it's so. Mm. I just want to just to say again to clarify. So you're looking in the palms of your hands, and at the tips you're seeing Lakshmi, and Lakshmi is that abundant state of consciousness. Abundance is related with the tips of the fingers. You're kind of giving money with your tips. You're taking in the energy from the tips. And then the middle, Saraswati, that wisdom, that knowledge aspect of consciousness. And, you can even read books with the middle of your fingers or study. And then the base, the mulam, is the Gauri, so that divine mother. And yes, that's like the energy is like at the wrist, right? That's Shakti.
Yeah.
And I'm after this, I'm going to get off you that feet on the earth one, the Samudra, because I've never done that and I'd love to. And I think it's just, this is what you'll learn, and the more you dive into the Vedas, and like, it just shows the wisdom that you have just incorporating mantras into so many aspects of your life. It's so beautiful and it gives you so much power. And I also want to say to those listening, like, don't think you have to have a mantra for every single thing you do. Like when you wake up, when you step on the ground, it gradually comes over time. But it enriches your life with greater sophistication.
Beautiful.
So please carry on.
Yes, so if you want to get a little bit more into the one on the foot of your
putting sure,
your feet
please,
on the earth.
Please. Yeah, I was going to ask privately, but let's share it for sure.
Sure. One thing, like when you're practicing your dinacharya, it's also like a art form. It's what we can say is like how creatively you put together your life, every day, your routine, right? So over time, you add a little branch here, a little flower there, a little fruit here, and you manifest something very profound over time, and it becomes your own. Now, a lot of the principles are the same, but depending on your school of thought, your culture, your education, it varies a little bit. So what I noticed is when you see the very experienced people, like, you know, the great Brahmins and the great enlightened gurus and who have been in practice of this acharana, this everyday routine practice of what is the right action, they can do the same thing in a matter of seconds. For a beginning student, it can take a long time to put this into perspective, and because it's the practice. How much you practice, that's how fast your body aligns itself to the speed of your mind. Because if you sit and you meditate on this, you can do all of this in a matter of few seconds. But when you want to put this into speech, when you want to put this into thoughts and into actions, it depends on your practice, how your body and your mind and your thoughts, your indriyas, your karmendriyas, your jnanendriyas, how aligned, how harmonized they are to this practice. So the more you practice, the more and more you practice, you refine it. In the beginning, it is very on a very gross relative level. Slowly, slowly, it becomes more and more internalized and internalized. Then then what happens? The same big mantras, you also recognize the bija. You also recognize the mudra. You also recognize. So you understand how to do an incredibly, you know, the entire expression of the Vedas. You can do it in the essential format. When you have a long day and you have to do many things. So how can you do all of this in a matter of few seconds? And because not every time you might have the time to do it in that slow and very relaxed. So then you can change the speed of it. You know, you can do it very systematically, very calmly, very elaborately. Or you can also do it in the essential form. And this essential form is not missing anything because it is in perfect alignment with your mind. And when you see these masters doing that in that speed, it's completely mind-blowing, you know, like how much they had to practice in order to get that speed. You can't even your eyes can't keep up with that. It's too fast. The steps that they're doing, the mudras and everything that they do, is so fast, you can't keep up with that speed. Even to observe, you can't pick it up. Forget doing it. So this practice is something that is amazing. That's where the, you know, lineage comes into a deeper understanding, because the practice that you are putting into your nervous system is what is going to be passed on to your next generation. So when you look at this in that sense, there is so much epigenetics involved. There is so much scientific understanding involved, how life is eternal. Life is not just this one person in this one lifetime. So then the whole understanding shifts. So this is something that I want to discuss a little bit today, because today is Guru Purnima. So how the guru helps us to, you know, to chip away our old habits, our vrittis, the imperfections in our chitta, how the guru guides us to chip those imperfections away again and again. And then we have what we are left with, pure chitta, pure awareness, pure consciousness. And there, when we have that pure consciousness, how we restructure it with the right samskaras, with the correct ethics, the right ethical dharma values, so that we don't recreate what we are going through, the patterns of our past don't repeat themselves. And there, a lot of this dinacharya and ritacharya and these principles, they play a big importance in that. We'll get into that a little bit more later on. So with regards to that shloka, Samudra Vasane, so this shloka particularly, it articulates the, you know, the praise and gratitude towards Mother Earth to draw inspiration and strength and the grace, and asking for her forgiveness because we are touching Mother with the feet. So this enlivening of this thought, this emotion towards the earth is so powerful, because you see, just like a child, when the baby, they will step on the father and the mother because they don't have that thinking. You know, we should not touch elders with the feet. They're very innocent, very pure. Similarly, we are so little and so tiny little babies in front of the grand celestial body of the earth. So we don't have a choice. We are just so, but we are also aware that she's so divine and she's so unbounded in her compassion and forgiveness. And we are asking for her strength and her forgiveness and showing our gratitude towards her. So innocently we are doing, without knowing everything, we are just doing. So we are remembering that.
Beautiful. Can you say the shloka again?
Yeah. Samudra Vasane Devi Parvatastana Mandale Vishnupatni Namastubhyam Padasparshe Kshamaswame. So this shloka is saying, O Mother Earth, you are that who is covered by the ocean and the mountains and the forests as her body, as a, you know, like the sari, the grand scarf that is covering her, who is the wife of Lord Vishnu. I bow to you. Please forgive me for touching you with my feet. Now here, when they say who is the wife of Lord Vishnu, there is two different thinking. One is that even the Lord Vishnu's wife is bowing down to you. And some say you are, because in another context, when we talk about Padmanabha Swami, the Bhudevi is also considered as the wife of Vishnu in a different context.
That's the earth, Bhudevi.
Yes. So it's a little bit interesting that that is a very kind of, you see, this is also going into why Lord Rama was always one woman man. He only had one wife. And this is the reason they say, because he had to be the king of the earth, he was not allowed in some way by nature and whatever, that his wife could not be with him. So when you say Bhupati, the kings usually get this title. They are, Pati means Lord and Bhu means earth. So this is, they say, why Lord Rama, he had to let go of his wife, because he had the responsibility of the earth.
And amazing. She went back into the earth at the end. That's really...
Yeah, she came from the earth, apparently. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, beautiful. And then,
so that is already quite a auspicious beginning.
Beautiful.
And, you know, then you just wash your face, put some water on your face. You know, the general dinacharya that you are doing, like brushing your teeth. What else?
scrape your tongue, go to the toilet,
urinate. Oh, by the way, did we mention the Brahmi Muhurta that you're supposed to wake up?
No, we didn't.
I'm sure everybody mentions that. Should I do that again?
No, because many people who in interview don't necessarily wake up at that time or know.
Okay. So Brahmi Muhurta is very important, the shloka. I'm sure you heard. Brahmi Muhurte Uttiste Svasto Raksharthama Ayushaha. So waking up early during the time when nature wakes up.
So earlier we talked about Muhurta as that time period or auspicious time.
Yes,
period.
Auspicious time period when Brahman means totality. The whole universe is waking up. At least in our relative existence.
Yes.
We are on this planet, so we talk about the Brahman here. So when all the different, plants, everything you can hear around that sunrise time, between 4 to 5:30, 6, in that time period, everything is becoming alive, more awake. And so that is considered the best time to wake up. Then, you splash your face with some water, clean your eyes, comfortable temperature. Now, the yogis, of course, then they drink, huge amount of water because, and it's usually cool temperature, like room temperature, not warm. This, you don't have to drink so much like the yogis because the yogis have built their capacity to drink even 2 liters or more. And they usually put it in silver vessels or copper vessels. And copper means you have to clean it more. Silver, you have to clean a little bit less. So you can put silver coins, gold coins in a copper vessel if you like. And that
you
water
multi-mineral water.
Yeah, so the water absorbs that kind of the nervous system, the intelligence, the vibration of that metal. And silver and gold are considered very special in that sense. So when you put that water into your body, it's cool. I thought it's interesting because you know how the warm temperature water, if you put it on your skin, the pores open up, right? So similarly, when you put this cool water into your body, you drink, I don't know, half a liter or something, a little bit more, as much as your capacity. It cleanses all the toxins in the channels. And at the same time, the pores, they become a little bit tighter. So it's kind of like that squeezing effect is there inside the body. And so I feel this is an important thing because a lot of people tend to drink something hot first thing in the morning. And so the first thing is supposed to be cool room temperature water, preferably in one of these containers.
Interesting. But I mean, also, it seems hot water also has that cleansing effect, or you're not getting that
hot
full,
water. Hot water afterwards. Mm. First thing is, you see, if you want to drink from a cup that has been used before, you don't put hot water and drink immediately. First, you wash it with the normal water or somehow, and the surface becomes clean. Then when you put the hot water, then whatever is the residue, it is opening more. So the absorption due to the warmness and the cleansing, it happens with whatever is left behind. The surface is first cleaned with cool water, room temperature water.
Mm-hmm.
It's very systematic. It's nanotechnology.
So then would it be after someone has their bowel motion, after drinking that, then they can drink the hot water?
Yeah. So immediately when you wake up, you wash your face and also you don't wake up so quickly. And the shlokas that we mentioned earlier, they make sure that you're not waking up suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important for the heart and for the circulatory system. So then when you just wash your face a little bit and you just, brush your teeth, and you drink this water, then the bowel movements become naturally, because the water is putting the pressure down and it's cleaning all the, the intestines and the stomach, the mucosal layers, the surface values of that. whatever ama, the toxins that have been due to rejuvenation, just like on our tongue, there is a lot of ama that is built up on the inner walls of our body.
So, it's the undigested food material.
Yeah. So all of that gets pushed. So then you go to the bowel movements, you do that, of course. And that is a very important habit to develop. A lot of people don't give that time because they're in a hurry and they're like, okay, it's okay. Let me just control right now. I don't have to. That's not good. Very important to maintain that habit, because any kind of suppression of those urges results over time in big problems.
One of the big causes for disease in Ayurveda, in many diseases, is suppression of natural urges.
Yes.
And as Aditya Ji just mentioned, yes, like you may not even realize you're suppressing it, but you're just so focused on hurrying or doing other things that it is being suppressed.
So, of course, some people, there is a little variation. Personally, I prefer to drink all this water before, like after brushing my teeth. And if I need to brush and do some more thing, I can do later. But just as soon as I wake up when I'm washing my face or something, I immediately want to clean my mouth. I don't want to drink that water and put in all the toxins in my mouth, into my stomach. Definitely. But then again, you know, then you can do a more thorough cleaning of your mouth, like the tongue scraping and gargling with the Gandusha oil. I think you are used to using the Raju's Gandusha oil, the special one.
Yeah.
But you can also use like sesame oil if that is not available, or rinse with warm water with some little salt or something. Like that. So then depending on what is accessible to you, that gargling, oil pulling is very important after brushing the teeth. Then you're doing a little bit of pratimarshanasya, very important, that everyday nasika oil in each nostril, that is cleansing your upper shrotas. So all this what we did is cleansing below the mouth, you know, below the neck region. Nasika, what it does is it cleanses above the neck, directly all the channels into your brain, towards your eyes, everything around the neck, the nose area. That is very important habit again, because a lot of the sinus and that kind of blockages can be prevented due to this nasika.
Sniffing medicated oil up the nose.
Yeah, yeah. So this should not be done before shower, just before the shower. It can be done, you know, like a little bit before, or before food, or before sleep. Or at the onset of a cold also, it should not be done. Just maybe a couple of days after the cold, you can do.
Yes.
And then, of course, the abhyanga, self-abhyanga, is very important. Self-abhyanga is massage with kunkumadi powder, or you can also use cured sesame oil or coconut oil, depending on what the vaidya is prescribing to you. Now, this daily abhyanga is an interesting thing, because so many of us are not habituated to this from the beginning itself, that it becomes a big event in itself to do everything. So in order to get habituated, even the Charaka and the great Maharishis in Ayurveda, they said, Abhyanga macharen nityam swajara shramavataha. They said to do everyday Abhyanga means to eradicate shrama, fatigue, tiredness, and vata, the imbalance of vata. But they said, then the second line, Shirashravana padeshu tam visheshena shilayet. They didn't give a lot of explanation. Everything is in seed format when they say in the shloka. So they say, okay, Shirashravana padeshu, the head, the ear, and the feet. They are the vishesha, they are very special. So naturally, one who does not have the habit of doing for the whole body, and you know, it becomes a big chore to do for the whole body. So they can only do maybe Sundays or weekends when they have more time. They don't have to rush to the office. In that case, at least minimum do the head, on top of the head a little bit, ears, the ear lobes and the whole ear, and the feet. This is minimum. This just takes, you know, hardly a minute or two. And there is not so much. So it's easy to get into the habit of oil massage.
Just like we wash ourselves every day in the shower, we should be also putting oil on our skin, and especially these vital points. So you can see on the Vital Veda website, you can get a free download a poster which teaches you how to do the self Abhyanga, the self oil massage.
So of course, after this, you wait for a little bit, you know, some 5-10 minutes, and then you take a shower, a nice shower. And one thing, so this is for generally for people, we can say like this, this is how to do. There is a, when you are doing more sadhana and yogic practice and all that, this changes a little bit. Because if you're doing a lot of asanas, then what happens is you produce also a lot of sweating, and purification starts to happen with the yoga asanas, the yogic exercises. So this usually means that you are doing the yoga asanas first, the different exercises, stretching and everything. And then you are doing the Abhyanga and the showering. And this is very important also, because one student was recently asking, like, if I'm doing the puja and the meditation, how should I do? Should I do that first and then this, or how? And it's very important to remember that what the Vedas are also teaching, to be established in the self and then doing the action. So in order to be established in ourselves, first what we are doing is we are going towards the meditation. And the meditation should be done in a very pure kind of atmosphere. So purity, when you treat your body also like a temple, your body becomes your temple. In that way, you first do the asanas, you do the, you know, the pranayama and the abhyanga and everything, and then you go for a shower. And immediately after the shower is like invoking the mother Ganga. So Ganga is the intelligence of water that is all purifying. And then you have also the other rivers, holy rivers. And so you invoke all of them, and you really create that pure feeling in your body, on top of your body. So this physical purification is on the surface value. You're cleaning with the water on top of your skin. You're cleaning with the water in the inner shrotas. So the different layers of your skin and below your skin, you're cleansing with water. Then what happens once you're done with all of that stretching and cleansing and moving all the peristaltic movements and everything, then your physical relative gross body on all its different layers becomes very clean, very pure. Then you sit down and you do your meditation. So meditation is the technique that allows you to be established in yourself. So the meditation, once you are established in yourself in pure awareness, not only on the grosser levels, but also on the subtlest level of your chitta, your memory, you're settling down your thoughts, your emotions, your feelings, all the things. You're settling it down, and so you're allowing yourself to not be so active, but to be more on the silent value. So everything, you start to, instead of running, you're walking. Instead of walking, you're standing. Instead of standing, you're sitting. It's all within yourself. And instead of sitting, you're even going deeper and deeper. You're diving into yourself, where everything becomes more settled, more calm, more peaceful, more harmonic. And once you establish in that pure awareness, which we call as samadhi, or beyond any of those impulses, beyond emotions, beyond everything. From there, you come out. And when you come out again to that, to the relative experience, the first thing that you do, the first action that you perform is your puja. We can ask very easily, why? Why is it so important that when we come out of the meditation, we should do something like that? Not before or not after. The reason we do, because the puja, it involves the sequence. The first deity that is enlivened is Ganesha, so that we don't have any obstacles in our day, in all the activities, whatever we want to do. The second, you're invoking all the different, your guru, your Ishtadevata, all the different divine intelligences in nature, and you're showing your reverence, your gratitude, your appreciation, and asking them for their blessings, their, you know, their guidance, and all of that. So when you do that in such a ritual, kind of a simple format, then without going to those lokas, in your own comfort of your home, you're connecting to those powers, those siddhis, and you're enlivening that in accordance to nature. And that becomes your first action of the day. Till now, you see, whatever we were doing, it was a preparation to that action. But as soon as it comes, the meditation is the most powerful step. The samadhi is the most powerful step towards nature support. Because once you're established in the altar within yourself, the divine altar of Almighty within yourself, then when you take that step towards whatever God, whether it is Ganesha, whether, you know, the elephant God, or any of the different, what for you is personal, it changes again. You know, each person's guru is different. The tradition might be different. So according to that, we do the ritual. And once we have completed the ritual, we go into our normal, you know, whatever other things we want to do. And this becomes very powerful.
Absolutely. Setting you up for a good day.
Yeah. So I would like to really congratulate you for taking Ayurveda so seriously and really following in the footsteps of the Vedic tradition, the great Vedic tradition, especially particularly in Ayurveda. That's really beautiful. And what you're doing, I really appreciate this work.
Thank you. It means a lot.
Yeah, and allowing me the time to speak in such elaboration and going into great details, that is also showing a really good quality of patience and ability to listen and really absorb and be present with the knowledge. Mm. So it's beautiful that you're practicing and not just listening to the words, but applying the knowledge into your routine.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for being so detailed. Because I love detail, so thank you.
Yeah, definitely. You know, when people are practicing yoga, meditation, and Vedic practices, one starts to notice that presence of mind, presence of their whole existence, and that dedication is deeply appreciated, of course. So I would like to ask you to elaborate on your daily routine. It's important also, you know, to see what is your take, especially because from each Australia, there is a difference in the land and the situation
and each like that, it's very important to give that reference to ourselves, how it is being in Australia with the Vedic routine. And I think that will also be very beneficial. So please, could you elaborate further?
Sure.
In that perspective.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I would, if there's anything you'd like to, I don't know, comment on throughout, please, I invite you to just stop me and add in anything, maybe with a suggestion of how I could alter it or comment or whatever. So I usually I always wake up in the Brahma Muhurta, which we discussed, that time of totality. For me, I don't send an alarm or anything, so it can be anything between 4 and 5:30 in the morning, depending on how my energy is and what I've been doing the day before and night before. And I will first go straight to the bathroom to wash my face with cold water, brush my teeth and scrape my tongue, because I feel that amma on my tongue and I keep it in my mouth until I fully scrape it off with my copper tongue scraper. And then I go to the toilet and urinate, and once my toxins have been removed from my mouth, I will take 1 teaspoon of a rasayana, of a rejuvenating elixir, herbal elixir called Shmiti. And I've just recently been gifted, first time I'm saying this or sharing this, but I was gifted an amazing, for a wedding present, a half gold, half silver spoon, or more than half silver, but just the tip of the round bit of the spoon, which goes in the mouth, is gold and the rest is silver. So I take my rasayana, my herbal paste, with that. And then I do that for 1 minute. I do a move my spine with this spinal sequence that I have. It takes 1 minute, and I just move my spine in all directions before sitting, to just to wake up the body a bit before I sit to meditate. And I meditate, followed by the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the Siddhis program, which can usually is anywhere between 1 and 1.5 hours. And then I will go to the toilet to have bowel motion, maybe before then or after then. And then I will do my Abhyanga, my Ayurvedic oil massage with a medicated coconut oil while sipping hot water. That's when I start drinking my water for the day. Because I like to, and I noticed you mentioned, which was an interesting point, drinking water very early. The reason I don't is because I don't want to mix it with my rasayana, my morning shmiti, my morning elixir. I want to leave minimum, 48 minute gap, that time period, muhurta, after taking the shmiti. So I meditate during that and then I start drinking my hot water. I drink it hot, unlike you mentioned to drink warm or room temperature, but and I'd love to discuss that, but I like it hot. And I have had periods when drinking a lot, I can't remember, there's a term for that, Adichi, it's what's the term when you drink a lot of water in the morning? It's like chatush something, maybe, or
chatush,
oh, I can't remember, maybe it's not, but there's one term for drinking a lot of water to stimulate the apana vayu in the morning.
I mean, one is definitely the flushing. So naturally, when you put the water in, it will flush. But also, the cool water is recommended first, room temperature, keeping in a silver vessel like that. Mm-hmm. Because you see, internally, all the channels will kind of contract.
Mm-hmm.
So it will squeeze a lot of the doshas, the amas out.
The cool water will make it contract.
Naturally. And so that's why the apana vayu, of course, the force of the water, but also the contraction. You can feel it inside when you're doing the exercise, stretching and all the asanas and like that. You can feel how that coolness. Again, of course, the body will come back to its core temperature. But another interesting thing you mentioned, that you said you know, bowel movements and evacuation? It's a very good question. A lot of seekers, they ask this question. Why this, you know, empty stomach and all this is recommended for a lot of this yogic practices?
Yeah, definitely.
Would you like to go a little bit further and deeper into this?
I think. I mean, if you're well, for example, like it's preferably in, if ideally, which mostly happens with me, but sometimes not, ideally it's before my meditation, because when I'm meditating, especially with the siddhis, the Yoga Sutras, it's, you want that clear channel, you want the ama removed. And when I'm more empty, I'm more light, I'm more lagu, I have that more sattva, which is that radiant pure light, which enhances consciousness state. Whether if I had, for example, undigested food or even digested food from the night before, which had not been eliminated, I still have a bit of heaviness. So it can kind of weigh me down during my spiritual practice of meditation. And then definitely I will get to later the yoga asana part and the exercise part. Definitely you want to be empty before that. And I think many people can feel that. But although some people do eat a meal before, protein meal before their exercise, but to be on light, empty stomach before exercise, there's much more room for, I guess, squeezing muscles and flexing muscles and moving all the aspects of the body. I'm so much more energized, because sometimes on the rare occasion, I haven't had my bowel motion till even after my Surya Namaskar, or I have had it, but it's not complete. And I can feel when I do my exercise, I'm not as, I don't have as much energy. So, yeah. Anything you'd like to add to that?
No, beautiful, beautiful. Please keep going.
Okay, so then after my meditation, I will, as I said, make some water, hot water, and do my Abhyanga at the same time. And my Abhyanga takes me maybe 10 to 15 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. And within all of this is self-pulse within this whole morning, within my whole Dinacharya, is pulse in between everything. So before and after spinal, that 1 minute spinal sequence, where as soon as I wake up, I forgot, which you also mentioned. So before the first thing, and when I wake up in bed, I rub my palms together, and as we mentioned, and say the mantra, Karave Vasate Lakshmi, Karave Saraswati, Karamule Tu Gauri Yaha, Prabhate Karadashanam. And excuse my mispronunciation, but when I say it out loud, that's why I like to prefer to say mantras inside, because it has that room for movement. And then when I put my feet on the ground, I say the mantra, which you essentially taught me, which I wasn't saying before, and that is the Samudra Vasade Devi. And I will let people see that mantra on the show notes. I'm not going to say the whole thing. And then I feel my pulse. And then I get up and go to the bathroom and do that morning brush, scrape, wash face, toilet. So then keep on feeling my pulse before meditation, after meditation, before Abhyanga, after meditation, throughout my Abhyanga actually. And including before and after some marma, some vital point activation techniques, which I've been blessed and so grateful to receive such precious knowledge and practices to integrate into my Abhyanga massage in the morning. And then after my Abhyanga, I'll basically go straight to the beach, which is about a 5 minute walk, and the beach is facing the sun. And I usually don't go at sunrise, because my program extends before then by this time, so it's sometimes around 7:30 a.m. or so, or 7 a.m. It depends how early I've woken up. And I will do 13 Surya Namaskars, 13 sun salutations, which is for the 13 Agnis of my body. And then after that, I'll do just some very quick, for maybe not even a minute, just some lying down on my back and twisting my legs, just to do a bit of core strengthening. And then I will go for my snan, my morning bath in the ocean, in Samudra Devi. And I will wash my oil off there, and then I will run back up the hill to my house, which is about probably a 5 minute run back. I've only since I've moved up a hill, it's been fun to run. I've never run much in my life, but I've been running home up a hill. And then I take another snack, a bath. I bath the salt water off and I use soap when I'm back at home. And then I basically usually either my wonderful partner makes me a very tasty chai tea, which I'll have herbs in it, or I'll just have a plain hot milk with ghee and some herbs. And that will be my breakfast. And with that, I like to then, while I'm drinking that, I read Charaka Samhita, one of the Shastras is what I'm reading now. And I read every day. Usually now it's one shloka. I say minimum one, but I'm basically reading one shloka, and I'm also transferring it into my writings and taking notes and exploring it. And then I basically start my day of work and clinic, patients. And I think I'll just stay with the morning dinacharya for now, and unless you want me to elaborate later. But that's basically it. Thanks for asking.
Oh, of course. That's very good. Yeah, I mean, basically, it's that the starting has to be ideal. And the rest will follow naturally, as we said, especially when you keep meditation as your center, grounding. Then you're infinitely flexible, yet absolutely grounded. Samula mantra, in fact. Infinite flexibility and absolute groundedness. It comes due to our transcendental meditation. And all the lineage of the Vedic parampara, this is what they have been teaching throughout eternity. Three times a day, sandhya. Okay, if not, at least two times a day. And always it brings us back.
Beautiful. I want to ask you a question. You mentioned these sandhya periods, or sandhi, and sandhi is like the transitioning periods of the day. And they're these powerful parts of the day, which everything is more towards transcendence. So that's why you suggested to transcend then, or meditate then. And you said twice, so sunrise time, sunset time. But you mentioned, I think you said that some Vedic texts mentioned, or something, that it actually should be three times a day meditation, with the third Sunday period, I assume, being midday. Now, we've learned a technique based on transcendental meditation, or and transcendental also teaches that, to be twice a day. So I'd love you to distinguish that difference of the twice a day, which is common these days. And you just mentioned three times a day. So where did that third one come from? Tell me about this.
Also, TM is teaching the third one. But it is more for the advanced practitioners. See, most of us, when we are just beginning around the world, around even in within India, so many people who know about the Trikala Sandhya, to do three times, even to do 20 minutes in one sitting, it's a challenge for them, especially in the beginning. So Maharishiji was so kind and generous that he kind of, you know, you can see his compassion and understanding and lenience, even though he's so perfect and so strict. But at the same time, he has that unbounded understanding, limitless compassion. And so he created a more understanding way for all of us to come back to the Vedic. Three times is even the number three. It's very particular.
Yes.
You will see great people, they use that three in particular instances, and it has a significance. So before we establish on that level, we should first focus on getting the two times ready. Perfect. And the third one, naturally, as we advance, our teachers and so forth will guide us into that, and we will see that.
Is that kala, that time, generally the midday?
As far as I understood, Maharishiji was, and a lot of the teachers are teaching the morning and then the midday, around sunset.
So the morning, midday, and sunset are the three, are the three kala.
So, but a lot of people, what they are doing is they are going for the morning and the sunset.
Yes.
Or the morning and the evening, before sleep. So the before sleep one is called Paramalva Seva, something they call it. It's a very particular kind of, you know, one that is very, actually very good. It's like just before going to bed, you are recollecting and rejoicing in the whole day and the event. And also, you see, just like within the breath, there is Shivatva, what we call as Chaturtha, that space in between. So this space in between is in between our contraction and expansion, inward and outward. This is the waves of silence happening between the infinite expansion and the infinite internalization. And between these two established states of awareness, a lot is happening. The whole of the universe is happening in between this. And similarly, the solar system also has, the planet also has, the galaxy also has. Everything has that pulse, spandana. So it really depends on ourselves, how we expand our consciousness, our awareness, pure awareness, expansion into pure awareness, getting established on that pure awareness, pure consciousness. And like that, we take it easy. We take it easy and we take it as it comes and practice. The intensity of the seeker
differs for everyone.
The intensity. Yeah, it differs, definitely differs. You know, when a seeker perhaps asks why I should empty my stomach, naturally, it's very logical to have an empty stomach, so the body. But also in spiritual practices, you see Vairagya Sannyasa is teaching absolute silence, absolute emptiness. It's also one of the ultimate practices. Even in Grihastha, the teaching is naturally coming to remain detached. Even, you know, with the people that we love and everything, children, everything, they will have this gravity to completely capture you. But then life starts to teach you how to fulfill your responsibility. But what is the importance of that silence? Why is it so important for spiritual practices? Because the space within the space and all the permutations of the primordial, they are allowing each other to move and flow within each other in perfect harmony while manifesting the elements to simply coexist in the divine union, in its infinite forms of purposeful functionality, are being created by nature, wherever they may be. It's such a beautiful question. It's such a profound question that as we evolve, it keeps coming back. It keeps making sense. What is this abstract silence? The space within all and its permutations and the elements, how they are allowing each other to move and flow within this container that we call a human body. It has certain densities, layers that prevents the other layer from escaping this layer. So it's a container within a container within that. And how they are moving, it all really depends so much on that emptiness. And that emptiness is also very directly and indirectly proportionate to many of the desires, requirements, habituations, responsibilities that we take on. And usually the master can see who is the genius and who needs some more time. And very comfortably, they're allowing this evolution to happen. So there's two ways, naturally, you know. Both are excellent. And especially the householder way is really special. It's the best because it very naturally teaches the people what, because of that combination of the husband, the wife, the family, and everything, it very naturally helps them to gain maximum benefit.
Yes. And the second one being the sannyasi, the recluse. And that space being, you was mentioned talking about how it's kind of confined and it has its boundaries within the body, but that space and those gaps, that sandhi also has its confinements within the day, within our day. And then this is what we're talking about here in this episode, is all about the day and the daily rhythm and that,
yeah,
that color, that time which comes every day. And within that, there's so much layers as well, just like the body and the physiology also in the day. And
yes,
Vichishi, perhaps we can go into like what, why we've kind of said it, but maybe if we just want to add anything else to why it is so important to have a dinacharya or to have a daily routine. I would add perhaps what's important is regularity. So not just random, this day I'm going to do this routine, next day I'm going to do this. Like, of course, it should be, it can be dynamic and different, but to have some, I guess, reoccurring theme and rhythm, which provides rhythm in your physiology. So, and something that you also, and of course, to enjoy it, that you enjoy. So what's
the
importance of having this dinacharya?
Beautiful question. So, of course, we talked about the emptiness and the importance and why sometimes when the seeker asks this question, we get into that. Also, it's very important to recognize what is the nourishment that the body requires. The requirement of the body, different kinds of nourishments and needs are dependent on the evolution, evolutionary state of that genetics. So one must keep that in mind. Just because emptiness is good, they should not just go fasting and doing all kinds of strong hatha yoga austerities and overwhelm their bodies. So they should always keep a balance of what is the nourishment that the body requires and expand the magnitude of that balance. That magnitude of your balance allows you to really, you know, pursue your spiritual seeking in harmony without overwhelming and all of that. So that being covered, I think it's a beautiful point that we got into. In general, one should take proper bath, wear neat clothes, clean clothes, considering the, you know, what colors according to the day and all of that, of course. Worshipping Lord Ganesha first.
And that's invoking that aspect of consciousness, which removes obstacles and gives that joy and bliss and Hasti Bala, that elephant strength for the day.
Yeah. One should go, when we worship Lord Ganesha, we are exploring our smriti. But now we are exploring it with a buddy, with a god, with an almighty friend who is able to remove all obstacles. So that dhyana, that prayer, it allows us to realize and recognize so much that maybe we were not able to pay attention. It's like when you have a really good well-wisher with you, they will help you to see things and remove obstacles that maybe you were not able to remove on your own. So Lord Ganesha is, that's why once we do all the morning routine, the first thing, the way we start our dialogue with nature is with the ideals that Lord Ganesha has kind of put into perspective for us: humility, viveka, buddhi, jnana, all these amazing, amazing qualities. So that's why first we remember Ganesha, the ideal son, who is the lord of all the ganas, the powers that be, the communications and all that which is happening between the infinite expansion and the absolute within. So then, of course, after Lord Ganesha, we do the rest of...
Before we move on from Lord Ganesha, I'd just like to ask, you mentioned he's, when we invoke or attune or ourselves with that aspect of consciousness, which the Vedas sound like Ganesha, you said we enliven the Smriti. So Smriti, if you had to translate it to one word, perhaps means memory. So I guess it's like...
Smriti.
Sorry, with the retroflex R. So, Smriti.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you. I appreciate that. So I guess it's like that elephant power memory, like you know, elephant and Ganesha is like that kapha, and it kind of has that real deep memory, and not just I can remember what I did 40, 70 years ago, but it's like, would you just briefly elaborate, if you can, on that Smriti aspect?
The Smritis and the Shrutis. Oh, better not get into that. That is
okay.
No briefness there. Just read the Upanishads.
Yeah, okay. Maybe another podcast episode will do that.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep this short, but you know, memories, our memories, so much. What you, the prarabdhas and the sanchitas and all the karmas, impossible to make this into short, even reading all the Upanishads are already a concentrated explanation of that. And even then we cannot understand. But in general, for our personal things, you know, when we are invoking Lord Ganesha in our onset, we are going through the different layers as we go further and further into our puja and according to our shrine and our, you know, dialogue with our shrine and the holy tradition and all of that. Naturally, the progress, once you have Ganesha on your side, he will also, you know, he has that memory and that capacity to listen and speak when it is absolutely required and what is required. He has all that siddhis and riddhis. So he's able to give what you require in that moment.
Yeah, beautiful.
So that's why he is the one who removes all the obstacles.
Mm.
Ganesha is that, you know, even he's compared as the, you know, thousand suns, the light, which is equivalent to thousand suns.
What is the
Very
name?
Very powerful.
You were going to say Sahas. What is the name?
Sahasra Koti Surya, the equivalent to a thousand suns.
Beautiful.
So, but also, you know, he's very funny. And he's also very much like a child because of being the child of Mother Parvati and Sadashiva. He has that childish nature, innocence, purity, but also this incredible absolute power. So in all that way, sometimes people might not understand how important he is. After some time they can forget, but he is the most important. So the first step is so powerful that it removes all impurities and all obstacles, and you must always kind of remember that. Just because we progress further, if we forget that primary, which is so powerful, just because it looks a little bit like, you know, with the elephant head and some stories and childlike, then we are losing what is fundamental to evolution.
Aditya ji, for someone who has never worshipped Ganesh before, and Ganesh is hardly part of their life except the fact they may have a painting of Ganesh or a statue in their room because it looks nice. How can someone integrate invoking Ganesh consciousness into their daily routine at a big, you know, someone who's just starting this?
Yeah, just what we talked about, you know, first cleaning our bodies, our minds, everything, and wearing clean clothes.
So this is for Ganesh also?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, beautiful. Because it's like that initiating aspect.
Yes, the first step we take towards him, if we are taking it with that reverence, as we would be taking with the highest, then, you know, we are putting our best foot forward. And that's what he's teaching. And how to sustain that moving forward, he's teaching that. But I don't want to go too much into this because otherwise we'll end up again 2 hours like.
Okay, beautiful.
So yeah, like that. And then the rest you do your work, whatever, eat. And again, coming back to the meditation. And then again, doing the, you know, evening sandhya. So again, cleaning the puja and everything. Again, the dinner on time with the family time, this, that. And then sleeping with the third sandhya, if possible. But that all this requires the guidance of an enlightened guru. An enlightened guru who is, and that I think there it's very interesting, you know, how the guru finds the seeker. When the seeker is so intensely seeking that he has nothing else in mind, that's the time when the enlightened master comes in. But the seeker is already prepared, you know, to recognize who is the right master for him, the right teacher, the right guru for him or her. And there, a lot of intricate dharma sukshmas will be there, because it's there, how to recognize your guru, all this information is there, how to recognize somebody who is not enlightened, how to record, different things are there. But at the end, you know, when you go to an enlightened person, there is so many. When you go near to them, if we are using too much smartness, that will also create some obstacles. If we are not aware, that is also some problem. So that's why this practice, meditation, is the key. How to be restfully, innocent, pure, but also alert. And when the time comes, we feel in our hearts, we feel it. It's full of that radiance of the master. And that ability to sense that, to feel that, to experience that fullness, that is the fruits of our practice, our spiritual practice, the patience. According to our patience, our capacity. And the master will fully test, of course, because such a fully enlightened master is not going to choose just anybody to take that position.
Beautiful. So I also, I would like to speak about this day today, which we are recording now, and called Guru Purnima, full moon that happens once a year. And maybe if you're listening years down the road, whenever it's coming, it usually comes around July, August. So before we speak about it, do you want to do any chanting to invoke that guru consciousness, that consciousness which removes darkness?
Yeah, definitely. So maybe we do a little pranayama before we do that.
Sure.
Okay.
Jai Gurudev.
Jai Gurudev. So just this pranayama can be so powerful to reestablish the three nadis, Ida, Pingala, and Sushumna. Then first we start with remembering Lord Ganesha. So the seed way to do that without prolonging too much, I feel everybody knows about the importance of Lord Ganesha. So what normally we can do is Gam Ganapataye Namaha, Om Gam Ganapataye Namaha, Om Gam Ganapataye Namaha. So this Gam Ganapataye Namaha, it is the seed which has the entire intelligence of Lord Ganesha in it. Now you can elaborate this as much as you want. So you can go with the shloka, Vakratunda, Mahakaya, Koti, Shulvi, Smatra. Or you can say, you know, the Pancha, Ganesha, Ashtotaras. There is so many. You can just elaborate the greatness of Lord Ganesha. We can even go for days and it will never end.
Great, we can do a podcast one day on Ganesha.
In fact, today, you know, Vyasa's, today also Vyasa, the great Guru Vyasa is also remembered yesterday and today. Mm. And the way he wrote all of this Vedas was with the help of Lord Ganesha. Because Vyasa, when he goes into the flow of knowledge, when he is describing, cognizing all total knowledge, nobody was able to keep up with that flow in terms of writing. So the one person who has that viveka, that buddhi, that level of intelligence is Lord Ganesha. So Lord Ganesha comes forward and says, this is a must for humanity in the future, because otherwise, you know, all this knowledge will be forgotten. So he says, okay, I will write it. And so without interrupting Vyasa one time even, he writes all continuous. So he's the only one who has that capacity to keep with that flow. And that's how the Vedas, you know, we have access to them in written format today. If it was not for what Lord Vyasa, Guru, the great universal Guru Vyasa, and what Lord Ganesha did long time ago. Then, of course, we have today's Guru Purnima, so we can say Om Gurur Brahma, Gurur Vishnu, Gurur Devo Maheshwara, Gurur Sakshat Parabrahma, Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha, Naguru Radhikam, Naguru Radhikam, Naguru Radhikam. So today especially is our opportunity to talk about the greatness of the Guru. They normally don't allow, you know, anybody to talk about their great virtues and their great deeds. But today we can talk about it freely. Nobody will object. Even the gurus will be like, okay. Because we are talking about the teacher quality within every particle of existence that can manifest in mysterious ways in different people. It can come forward. And sometimes it manifests as a complete incarnation. Those are usually what we recognize as the Jagadguru incarnations, like the legendary Adi Shankaracharya, Vyasa Bhagavan. And of course, Lord Krishna is also recognized as the Jagadguru, because what he gave, especially in the Bhagavad Gita, it is such a concise format of all the Vedas. You know, basic complete guidance in such a small context. But if you read it, you can expand it. It will just be endless. So today we are thinking and remembering all the great gurus and the Vedic Guru Parampara. And what is it that the gurus are doing? You know, why is it that they are coming and roaming on this earth, even when they don't have to do all of that? You know, they are fully enlightened. Why they are walking about? Because the enlightened never come back. You know, they are, what you say, moksha. When they are already liberated, why still they are doing so much for us, coming to this world and mingling in this confusion and all of this ignorance. And it is what they say as the compassion they have. Compassion, forgiveness, tolerance, empathy, all these great values, because they recognize without the unified effort of all humanity coming into that ideal potential being completely, fully activated in perfect harmony, we cannot create heaven on earth for all. So the gurus have taken this charge to be the guidance. You know, they bring the light of knowledge to remove the darkness of ignorance. And even though they don't have to, they can sit in the comforts of their caves or their heavenly abodes. But still something pulls them, you know, so many people, and they do it not as if they are making some big sacrifice. They make it also look so effortless. If you see the great Shankaracharya and all the Jagat Gurus, when you see them, they don't make it look like it's such a stress for them or it's such a big trouble for them. They just make it look so blissful and so joyful. So in that sense, even though they are coming to the planet in the middle of Kali Yuga, in the middle of all this confusion and loss of memory, lots of thinking of what is the right action, what are the right values, they are not in that. Because they are established in the beyond, what we say as pure consciousness, because they are established in para, that which is beyond, that which is beyond description, beyond any kind of manifestation. Even though everything manifests from that, that silent dynamic value of nature, the absolute silence, because they are established in that constantly, fully, permanently, so they embody that. And you see also the way they move in the world, they are very active, but they're very detached to everything at the same time. They're very involved, they enjoy, but they don't need it. So that full enlightenment state, when you see and when you recognize such people, you can see their samskaras, they're very different. And for us, it's impossible to fathom that. Because we are in a different state of consciousness, it becomes very difficult for us to completely experience that on that state. And the only way we can do is to kind of try and follow in their footsteps, how they are doing, what they are doing, and asking them and learning from them and deserving more and more of that by our reestablishment in spirituality. Spirituality means totality, everything. So this is why in the Vedas, when we look at the Vedas, spirituality is not just religious practices. That is a very important part of spiritual growth. But if you see, mathematics becomes spiritual in the Vedas. Medical system, Ayurveda, becomes spiritual in the Vedas. Science becomes spiritual in the Vedas. Everything, whatever exists, it is integrated, totally integrated with each other. Ayurveda is integrated with engineering, metallurgy. Mathematics is integrated with everything else. Astrology is integrated with everything else. Architecture is integrated with everything else. So spirituality is not, in that sense, it is not your personal ideal or religious or philosophical belief. Spirituality is a universal understanding of what is the source of everything. Whatever your ideology might be, how to respect each other's philosophies, how to coexist in harmony. And it is the guru who brings this awareness of the self to us. It is the all-knowing enlightened master who brings this awareness to us, whether directly or indirectly. It is that quality, that intelligence of nature that is guiding us, that is teaching us, that is imparting knowledge to us. Whether it comes in the form of a stone, or it comes in the form of a tree, or it comes in the form of a mother, father, brother, sister, friend, doesn't matter in which form that knowledge is coming to us, it is coming from that source.
That Guru Purnima, that Guru actually is, I believe, the translate. One translation can also be the remover of darkness, because Gu is darkness and Ru is remover.
Mm.
So, of course, the moon is doing that, and the bright full moon is doing that, and also any individual. And also, for those who don't have a master or a guru, I believe, is that right to say, you know, anyone who is removing darkness from your life, whether it's a teacher, whether it's a physician, someone who teaches you anything that you value and that removes some ignorance for your inner light to radiate, that also can have, to some different extent and to a different level, that influence.
Beautiful, beautiful. We are actually going to a very important point, because somebody who is a universal master, if you see all of these very legendary universal gurus, they are not necessarily a vaidya or a pandit or an astrologer, but within them, all of that knowledge exists. But they're much more multifaceted than just that. So if you see, their disciples are also very selective. In the case of Adi Shankaracharya, he only had 4 disciples that, you know, he would say, these are my students, these are my disciples. But in a universal sense, through that 4, he was giving the knowledge to all the people, the entire universe, not only people, everything. He was imparting that blessings, that grace of Vedas, and he was doing that to everybody. But these 4 became his 4 immediate connection to everybody. So there is a structure there, right? But when we talk about learning knowledge from everybody, then the mother is the first guru. The mother is the one who is first access to the child. So she becomes the first teacher. Then the father. So that's why the shloka, Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava. Acharya is the teacher, you know, whether in our school, in our society, the people who are taking the role of a teacher. Coming to our universal kind of our understanding of the guru, who we accept as that all-knowing, all Paramatma, Guru Sakshat Parabrahma, the Parabrahman. There is a difference between Brahman and Parabrahman. Parabrahman is the almighty, almighty, omniscient, omnipotent being. When that manifests in a form, in a person, that is a completely different thing. So we can have many, many teachers. We can find some teaching even in a tiny little insect, or even when a dog behaves in a divine way, when the dog is helping somebody, saving somebody's life, it is teaching something. We can say, oh, this is a divine action from a dog. So we can see divinity in the dog. We can see divinity even in creatures that don't have even nearly as much cognitive capacity as human beings. So even with such creatures, we can learn. We can learn from everything that exists. But when all of that existence manifests in one form, that becomes a personal choice. And that personal choice, it depends on our state of consciousness. How much do we know who we are? How much do we understand about ourselves? Because only based on that, we can recognize the right guru for us. This is why so many people, they can be a little bit in a hurry because maybe they understand the importance of having such an enlightened guru. So, you know, whoever they find enlightened, they'll be like, okay, this is it. I have found my guru. But the enlightened guru will know who is the right guru for you. And if you are in a hurry, if you are, so in order to not disappoint you, then they will guide you a little bit towards finding. Mm. But then that becomes a little bit more, there'll be more tests and more challenges. That means the time is not right yet. And then things can get a little intense sometimes. Things can get a little bit confusing, what is happening. But a more realized person, a person who is realized, who are they? What are they? So this is why the spiritual initiation into education, it happens at a very young age in the Vedic tradition. It happens when we are 5 years old, 7 years old, maximum 9 years old, if the child is a little bit stubborn or, you know, something. So this initiation is immediately putting the child towards knowing who they are, towards knowing what is their purpose, what is their existence, what is their divine nature. And once they become aware of themselves and all the different aspects of the Vedas, the 40 aspects of the Vedas, Rigved, Samved, Yajurved, Atharved, Siksha, Kalpa, Vyakaran, Nirukta, Sankhya, so many different aspects, branches. Then what they do, they make an informed decision based on their divine nature. This was the Vedic system where all the enlightened gurus were available. And once you become aware, what is your school of, like if you want to study mathematics, then you will go for the enlightened mathematics guru. If you want to study physics, you will go towards the enlightened physics guru. And then there again, it's not so simple because if you want to be the personal disciple of the highest of that lineage, then you have to show the deservingness, you know, because their time in that body is also limited because we're all functioning on a relative existence. So unless you are on that caliber to be right there in the top structure, otherwise you don't need that much attention. So this you'll see again, this is where the recognizing of the jiva atma, the evolutionary status of the Atma. How evolved is the soul? It comes into a better picture.
You're like, what's your worthiness, I guess? What's your deserving power is a better way of saying that.
Yes. And that deserving power is not based on where you are born. This is a big confusion that happens in, you know, throughout Treta, Dwapara, Kali Yuga, people make, oh, where you are born is more important than who you are. No, no, no. Where you are born can be a supportive structure to your culturing and your nourishing and your education to make it more easy. That's very important also, the culturing. It, when you think about it in a genetic, you know, upbringing and all that format, the culturing, the environment in which that body and mind evolves becomes important. But that is not what makes the deservingness. The deservingness can be born anywhere in the world. Preferably, if I'm a Vaidya, if my nature is to be a healer, to be a Vaidya, then its preference is to be born in an environment where everybody is thinking similar. So then what happens? The enlivening of the samskaras becomes more quick, more easy, more coherent. So nature support is more. So that's why they created these different kind of what you say as vargas. And later on, that became to be misunderstood by people and by different situations and a lot of confusion.
Caste system.
Yeah, there is a lot of confusion there. Yeah. But if you think about it, I put it in a very simple format. If you look at, a farmer, he will put together the right kind of plants and he will see which fruit is having the sweetest quality and the juiciest quality and which flowers, and he will create a better and better version of that quality, right? A better nervous system, a better physiology, anatomy in the farming technology. Similarly, when you see the Kshatriyas, for example, they do a lot of
warriors.
This. Warriors, yes. They do a lot of this with the elephants and the horses and the different animal kingdom, because they want to have the most powerful elephants, the most powerful horses, you know, with the highest stamina. So then they will start breeding that intelligence of the best quality in order to create a better version of that nervous system, that physiology. So similarly, the rishis, the ancient maharishis, they naturally structured that into the culture, where they said, okay, how many Y chromosomes are there? The Saptarishis and one more, 8 rishis, Bharatvaja. So 8 Y chromosomes. So they called it, you know what they called it? Gotras.
Yes, gotra.
The 8 gotras. And this 8 gotra, it's like a mathematical formula. There are certain rules. They cannot marry within the same gotra. So they can only marry in between the different gotras. So this avoids what you call the recessive gene from remanifesting and creating a weakness. So the inbreeding and all that can be avoided. So then they are marrying in between these gotras, and also the rishis, the gurus, were having this knowledge, this technology. So they were seeing what was the karma of this ancestry. So they will go at least 10 generations and they will know, okay, what did the father do? What did the grandfather do? What did the great-grandfather do? At least 10. In the case of Rama, they went all the way to the beginning. All the way to when his lineage started by the sun god. But in normal, they do at least 10 so that they have a cosmic account of what karmas are coming together. And what can we expect? So the gurus, they plan according to that. And if it is a good match, it's not just astrology. It's genetic engineering at its most natural, integrated, spiritual form. Not in some laboratory, forcing people to do and not telling them what is happening. Here it is happening in a very natural way for the betterment of humanity so that they can create a more evolved nervous system, a more deserving Atman can embody that.
And I love how you said it evolves. So I'll just share my experience, you know, like when starting to learn with your family, it was such a slow process of having time with the guru who were, you know, the doctors there, the physicians teaching me Ayurveda. And I started with, I remember sitting with one of the patients at the clinic who was a very long time patient and thus knew a lot of Ayurveda. And they were just teaching me about what they had learned from the doctors there. And that even was just a great, you know, introduction. And then you know, gradually, and it's of course still developing, and it will continue to develop inevitably. So it's just to not, you know, think, and definitely, like, you know, it's more rare to have gurus so intimately, but, and there's immense value in having that, but it will evolve, and nature will provide what's relevant at certain times. And
absolutely. Yes. You see, when I actually, this is a great example. Thank you for bringing that to my notice. In some way, I just realized, if we take you, for example, you're born somewhere in Australia, but you found your way to this knowledge. You know, what happened? What is it within you that made you so certain to dedicate your entire life to Ayurveda and to this kind of a ancient tradition? It can't just be you. I mean, in the sense of this body and this mind and this ego of I-ness. It's something within that I, within you, that is guiding you towards this direction. So here is a great example. It's not about where you are born. It is about who you are and coming into recognition of that and knowing that this is what is your path. This is what is your purpose. So many enlightened people like this, they're born in some of the most unimaginable circumstances. And out of that, they come into becoming the greatest masters of humanity. They're able to give this knowledge and give the guidance to so many people. You know, you're born somewhere, you know, across the ocean in some other continent. And you came all this way and you're learning about this. And you're now, you know, creating this platform through podcast and through all the efforts that you're putting in to share this wisdom and to share and to create health for all and to give that offering to humanity. There isn't much, you know, nobler, what do you say, dharma. Not only are you practicing healing, you're also teaching it. You're also promoting it. You're also, you know, and supporting this Vedic tradition that has been forgotten by so many.
It's enhancing the dynamism within that Guru Shishya tradition, that Guru student, you know. Now I'm teaching, and then these students are then connecting with my teachers, the Rajus. So now it's happening online, and now it's, so all this, it's a dynamic, and it has so many ways of expression, so many ways of relationships.
Mm.
You know, then one day someone will land up in India learning specifically and being initiated in person from something. So, so many levels, and not to think it has to have to be spending a time with a guru all the time. Oh, that's amazing, but there's so many different, it depends on, you know, where you're at in your journey, in your stage of evolution, and it will just keep evolving.
If
there's so many things to enliven that relationship in regards to the respect and the devotion and the, for lack of a better word, obedience. But it is important. I'd like to talk about something interesting which I've realized in a guru shishya relationship. Shishya means like pupil or disciple, and this. First, I'm not going to say much on, but like the love for a guru is so profound and very high, like on its own level, on a very high level. And I'm going to leave that aside. But on that note, the other side of when, I think, I don't know if it's a term, but like guru krodha, like when the guru gets a bit angry or like a bit strict, when it initially happened to me, I mean, like, it's actually very enlivening and like kind of for when it started happening, like it's on the very few occasions, because as you know, my gurus are a few members of your family, essentially all of your family I consider my guru. And particularly your uncle, who I spend most time with, he's the most blissful person I've ever met, and he's very hardly negative and angry. But with me, it happened a few times, like some strictness, but that also indicated to me like this is a good thing, because he's like kind of, I don't know, directing me and enlivening me, and it shakes me up. And there's been times where that has made me like very emotional in a not like in a very negative way, but just enliven something within me in a deep level, and almost also enlivened like a sense of trust and connection that he can be like that to me. So I'd just like you to talk about this phenomenon of this strictness kind of thing. Of course, some gurus are very strict and will be like this, but I don't know, particularly coming from someone who's the most blissful person. Let's talk about that.
Actually, you brought out a beautiful point. Now, the gurus who are very strict, you know, they are the most special ones. Mm-hmm. A lot of people can't withstand that kind of strictness. I can go into some stories that can really make everybody wish that they had such strict gurus. But not everybody deserves them. Not everybody deserves them. And it is good because, you know, even their body cannot, their nervous system cannot withstand that intensity.
Because it's not like a regular teacher being strict at school or your parents being strict. When the guru is strict, it is intense. Like, it's like this person who you have this is why I mentioned love, is because you have this such a strong love, like such a unique love. I can't explain it much, but it's so much different. But, and then they're strict to you, like, whoa, like that really shakes me up.
Yeah, really. Like, I can give you a couple of small examples.
I'd love to hear stories.
You heard of Milarepa?
No.
So this is the very famous Buddhist incarnation of one great guru, Bodhisattva guru, in the Buddhist tradition, where some injustice happens to this child. The father, you know, he dies. Then the family in the village, they take advantage and they take everything from them and they mistreat them. So he goes and he learns some siddhis, some things, and he comes back and he wants to harm the people who harmed his family, you know, his own uncles and aunts and like that. But in the process, he ends up harming the whole village. And he suddenly realizes what a big karma he has created for himself. So he becomes very afraid, like, I have ended up killing so many people and, you know, destroying so many houses and all this. How do I manage? So he goes to he finds one Buddhist monk, and he asks him to give protection, to help him. And the Buddhist monk, he sees what happened. And then he makes him take some vows and he says, okay, only then I will think about it. And he completely surrenders to him. He says, okay, fine. Then what he does, long story, very big story, I'm cutting it short. Then to this Milarepa, the student, he can see that he already has some very powerful, because it's not a joke that he can have so many siddhis at such a young age. On his own, he learned somehow. So he says, okay, fine. Now you have to do what I say, and only then. So he says, okay, now build this tower, this stone tower. And he says, okay, so it's very difficult to build these huge towers made out of stones in the mountains. He builds one stone tower. Then the monk says, oh, I don't know, maybe not the right place. Now take it off and build it in this place. And he's like, oh, okay, fine. Again, he destroys the tower and he builds again. He says, no, it's not good. Okay, why don't you build here? Take that down. And, you know, those stones are heavy pieces to move and to take away. It takes a lot of time and energy. And he keeps making him destroy and build, destroy and build, destroy and build. But every time he's become more frustrated. He's like, no, I promised him that I would not question him. I'll do as he says. And every time he's building. over time, over and over and over and over, finally one time he says, why am I doing this? Like, you know, I don't see each time I'm doing the same tower with the stones, why so much effort? You know, what is happening? I know I shouldn't be asking, but after building it for the 1,000th time, can you please tell me what's going on? Then the guru says, okay, now you're done. Your penance, the reason it had to be so intense was to burn that karma. So you see, it's a very practical solution to a very physical accumulation. So whatever karma we are doing, whether the food we are putting into our body, the actions, the memories we are putting into our nervous system, whatever it is that we are creating, there is a practical way to bring it out of your system. Now, there is a comfortable way, which I would say is the most comfortable, is TM. You sit, you close your eyes, you dive within yourself. And at your own comfort, at your own leisure, luxury, you work out whatever has happened in this lifetime, in whatever previous lifetimes, whatever it might be, the accumulation, you work it out. But then there is also what they have, this very particular intense one, which brings back those karmas to you immediately, very powerful. It's not for everybody. So you if you look at it, even that effort that he was doing, we have similar stories also in the Vedic historical records where the master was making them stand in the middle of the sun, on top of hot stones, in the middle of the fire. Very intense. So the body, it starts to digest all the whatever it is already. So not only on the nervous system, the meditative aspect, but also on the physical layers, everything is becoming, you know, the sweat is coming out, the grinding, the fats are being dissolved, new fats. So then this is a very important point, destroying the old karma, chipping away at the impurities on the level of the memory, on the level of the physical, anatomical, physiological layers of the muscles, veins, vascular system, arteries, all the tissues, bones, bone marrows, all those grinding and coming out through the form of mala, whether it is the sweat, the nails, the hair, it is coming out. And so then the new, what you put back into your body, the new samskaras, whether it is the thoughts that you expose yourself to, the habits you restructure, whether the dinacharya, the ritucharya, the new samskaras that you structure, if it happens under the guidance of an enlightened master in a safe environment, because when that transition is happening, from the old and that big surgical transitional movement into the new, you're in a very tender, delicate, vulnerable situation. That is why it's not practical for that to happen without the guidance of somebody who has already been through that. You know, if you try to do it in the middle of the city where the collective consciousness is not at all in a controlled environment. So the ashrams were like these ancient spiritual laboratories where whatever mistakes of the past is in the past. You start to become into the present, taking the wisdom of the past. You learn from the mistakes, your repentance, and it all becomes very real. It's not just like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, so many people just say, I'm sorry. How much do they mean? Because if they mean it, that same thing will not repeat. No? But when you do this intense spiritual surgery, then that thing becomes real, becomes constant awareness. That is something, that direction I will never go. that direction of adharma, the direction of poison, ignorance, never again. It is not even worth, even a little bit not worthwhile. There is no more mood making. There is the reality and there is the false. And you're always going to be in the reality, in established in pure satya, the truth. And according to your capacity, you start building it. You start building it. You start building. No matter how much, if it takes one lifetime, 1,000 lifetimes, doesn't matter. Sometimes nothing seems to happen. But sometimes in a few moments, lifetimes of evolution seems to happen. So it's not about how much is happening constantly or in a moment. It's about your perseverance, your dedication, your devotion. And for that, the guru, the feet of the master, that is your focal point, because that is where you will find all the guidance, all of that. Because the guru is the one who is introducing you to your God, your Almighty. He becomes even more important than your God.
Yeah, there's so many ways to, so many paths to, you know, remove those samskaras that literally is like where the word scar comes from, those irrelevant memories and all those, and to purify. And I think we have to wrap up, but I just wanted to speak lastly about, you know, we said, you know, you don't have a guru, that's okay, you can learn from many things, but really to have a guru, and I know it's a bit more rare these days, so I don't want to kind of like bewilder people or you have to find a guru, but if you can find someone who you can have this guru relationship with, having a guru is really like one of the ultimate ways to fast track your evolution and expand your awareness in such a heightened way. Like I mean, you sent me something, this Guru Puna, a beautiful thing. I'll read it actually, from Guru Ashtaka, and it says, "One's physique may be superb, one's consort likewise, one's reputation renowned, and one's riches as high as Mount Meru. Yet if one's mind is not centered upon the lotus feet of the Guru, what then? What then? What then?" So that was from the first stanza of Guru Ashtakam, a devotional song composed by the legendary Adi Shankara, who we spoke about. But yeah, it shows, you know, and not just that, there's so many other examples of it's, and you just said like Guru is more important than God. So it's or priority in terms of where you're at in the journey. So it's just, if you can establish that relationship with Guru, it really enhances evolution and fast tracks.
Yeah, right? And it's first let's talk about the shloka that what we were just you were describing. One interesting thing is the next shloka, the next Throtakastakam that I sent after this, what you just read. You listened to that one?
No, did you send? You sent me a live puja.
Right after this one, this Guru Ashtakam, I sent you a... No, I did send you. Right after this, if you see, there will be Throtakastakam.
Okay.
This is very interesting story, actually. Throtakacharya was one of the four disciples of Shankaracharya. Now, it's very important story, I feel, because he was, let's say, out of the four, he was the most innocent one. He was the one who was always washing the clothes of Shankaracharya, cooking, doing all the kind of the labor work, the Shudra in the four, you can say. So, you know, like not Shudra, but, you know, similar in that context, he was doing the labor work. And he was always in awe of his Guru Bhai, his brothers, and Shankaracharya, how much knowledge they had and how amazing and enlightened, always pearls of wisdom flowing through them. But he was simply doing his thing. He was like, you know, cleaning their clothes, cleaning his feet, giving his foot massage. And he was doing all that responsibility. So when he would speak, sometimes he would ask very basic, like kindergarten questions. So his other brothers, the three other disciples, they would, you know, they would sometimes joke with him a little bit, teasing him a little bit. Oh, you know, what are you doing here? You know, I don't understand why he selected you. What is going on? And he would smile and he would not, you know, it's my brother. So he would not take it personally, of course. He would enjoy. He had a good sense of comedy, I think. And then one day, the three disciples were sitting with Shankaracharya and they were talking about their, you know, they composed very profound knowledge and they were sharing that with the master, Adi Shankaracharya. So the guru was listening. At the end of it, somebody, I think one of the disciples, just says, but Totaka, he's not doing anything. You know, even now he's at the river washing the clothes. Why you are giving so much importance to him? They just asked a very humble, very innocent question. Like, why you selected him when there are so many other learned, deserving disciples? Why you put him in this level? And then the guru smiles and he says, then now is the time you see. And as soon as he says that, Totaka, he was somewhere very far away in the river washing the clothes. But suddenly he starts chanting this profound Totakashtakam and he comes to the assembly, to the classroom, and he's giving this Ashtakam flowing through him, just flowing without any obstacle, without any imperfection, pure devotional connection to the master. And that's when the rest of them realized that he was even more powerful than all of them. He didn't know anything. And in the Ashtakam, he was saying that, like, I am completely ignorant. I don't know anything. But you are the one, you know, you are the one I take my refuge. And so he became the perfect channel for the wisdom of Shankaracharya to flow. In all the others, there was some lesha vidya, you know, some awareness of I-ness. But in Totakacharya, there was no I-ness, only guru, 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 naguro radhikam. There is nothing greater than the guru. He's always guru, 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 guru. So he was completely focused, completely established in the guru. So the knowledge would flow through him as if the guru was saying himself. There was no difference between him and Adi Shankaracharya. And everybody, because he was walking all the way from the river, everybody in the town, the village, everybody could see, is this Totaka or is this Adi Shankaracharya? And the realization dawned on them that he was at the final stage of the evolution towards enlightenment, which is devotion. Devotion in the beginning is mode making. It's like, you know, bhajan, kirtan, chanting, enjoying, good. But for Totakacharya, 24/7, what is the need of the guru? What does the guru want? What is guru? What is guru? That devotion, you see that very rarely, like with Hanumanji, you can see 24 hours, all the time, his entire existence is Rama, 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 Rama. Totakacharya, so he was, even though he seemed so innocent, not studying anything, not knowing all of this Vedas, he knew everything. He was all so in alignment with the master. And the rest, they still had to catch up to that. So that's why you see Totakacharya in many situations, Adi Shankaracharya put him in the front. Because, you know, he knew that there was no impurity or no obstacle between him and that, and the Vedic knowledge that was flowing through this tradition. So they were the perfect embodiments, the perfect instrumental, pure bodies and minds for that knowledge to flow. So similarly, all of us, when we maintain that purity in our nervous system, in our body, the more we maintain that purity, the more we can handle that flow.
Yes.
And you see, nowadays, I want to go touch a little bit on this subject. You see, nowadays, a lot of people are using a lot of allopathic medicines and different kinds of medicines to help them to study, to help enhance their cognitive abilities and this and that and that. Now, what is happening with this kind of drugs is they're opening certain channels, but the nervous system, because it did not build itself to that, it takes a stress. See, if I'm trying to put 10,000 volts amperes of electricity through a circuit board that can only handle maybe 1,000, then what will happen to that nervous system, that circuit? It will create a stress. It will create some burn, some residue, you know, some of that. And that will further make it difficult for it to function even on a normal level. Even when you're putting 1,000 or below 1,000, that burn will create a kind of a less efficient way of functioning. This is why whatever herbs, whatever other you know, things we are using, especially when it comes to using, you know, certain rasaushadas, they are what are considered divya aushadas.
So the mineral.
Minerals, soma, all these more divya. What we say divya aushada, they are divine, more divine herbs. So they are explained as to be used with respect. So if you're giving something so powerful to somebody who doesn't even have that nervous system to handle that bandwidth of energy, then it can create a stress on the nervous system. So similarly, also the yogic practices, meditative siddha practices, if you are giving something when the nervous system and all that is not on that level of purity, then it can create a stress. You heard the story of you know, some very enlightened masters like Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. So Ramakrishna Paramahamsa is a devotee of Mother Kali. So there is a, it's in his book also, this part is there. He was saying to Mother Kali, you know, don't hold yourself back. I want to experience all of you, you know. And she was saying, no, your nervous system is not ready for this. But he was like, no, I don't care for this body. I don't care. And he was so stubborn and adamant. She said, okay, fine, you know. And then the energy was so powerful that even he was apparently, his whole chair and everything was levitating on the into the ceiling. And it was so strong that afterwards he became paralyzed. So somebody so powerful, so enlightened, so such a great tantric yogi, even he was, his body had certain limitations. So we have to see how carefully we have to advance in this. It is not just a lifetime thing. It's many, many lifetimes of evolution. And if we don't put in that work right now, if we don't take that into consideration, what we are producing, the genetic engineering that we are able to do, the life that we are able to create, it is depending on the mother and the father and the culture and the environment and the education and all of that. And we are stuck in the past. Who did what? We are thinking, who did what? This blaming each other, that is no way to progress. The progress is, okay, whatever our ancestors, whatever might be there, our own, which is, and who is our ancestor? We are repeating ourselves. So whatever might be our past, we learn from that and we start to structure those ideal Vedic education and values so that we give the right environment for the next generation. We give the right nervous system, and over time, it will take a couple of generations. But, you know, after a few generations, we can clearly expect enlightened beings born in every family.
It's a beautiful message, you know, no rush, no having this mentality of I want it now. It's for all things. As I said, the allopathic medicine, you know, these plant medicines like ayahuasca and these things which are being experimented with, and even doing a certain meditation practice, yogic practice, trying to attain a certain relationship with a guru, all that, you know, it can definitely bewilder the body, so, and the nervous system. So yeah, just take it as it comes in the right course and we'll flow. Okay, beautiful. Anything else you want to leave listeners with for today?
Oh, so many things, but I don't know.
We'll get you back on. We'll do another, at least. Another.
Yeah, I think it would be better if we can keep on going. Yes. Like this with so many things. But we can touch again sometime soon. Great. And continue this.
And if anyone listening wants to have a consultation with Aditya, like a health consultation, Ayurveda consultation, you can email info@vitalveda.com.au and we'll connect you and arrange that via Zoom. And yeah, get directed this direct consciousness with for you specifically in much more than health, as you can, it would be all aspects of the Veda. So,
beautiful.
Thank you, Aditya. Jai Guru
Dev. My pleasure. I will actually add one final note to this whole podcast. That is meditation.
Mm.
The key to everything is structuring your life around your meditation to be established in yourself, in your divine nature. When your whole life is structured around that practice, then greater support of nature very naturally comes to us. Very innocently, very pure, natural way.
Beautiful. So important. Jai Gurudev.
Jai Gurudev.
Jai Gurudev. A typical salutation that we chant or say before or after any knowledge session, or even as a greeting in general, and it's to acknowledge that I am not the source of this knowledge. I am not the innovator of this knowledge. There is a deeper source, and it's coming from and manifesting within me through various pathways for various reasons. So that is what we say. You will hear throughout the podcast episode, certain guests use that, Jai Gurudev, as to say, just to remind ourselves of that greater divinity where this knowledge springs forth from. So thank you for listening. And yes, if you want to book a consultation with Aditya, you want to get this deep insight into your health, to your overall spiritual journey or physical health, mental health, whatever it is, you can email info@vitalveda.com.au and yeah, request a consultation with Aditya. I'm usually there and it will be a three-way Zoom consultation. And he will give you many beautiful things for your healing and answer your questions. And if you want to join the Pulse Course with Aditya's family, you can check out the Vital Veda Courses page and check out the other episodes on this show. We've done a podcast with Aditya's brother and sister, Dr. Harsha and Dr. Pavani Raju, and that you'll see back in the Vital Veda podcast. And there's other wonderful, wonderful episodes, especially this year. We've been going plentiful with the Vedic topics. So until next time, my friend, much love.